Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Varta Weekly. This is the 95th weekly. We're inching towards 100. I have Prasanna Vishwanathan and Nirav Kanodra here to run you through the news and events of the week that was. Hey Nirav, hey Prasanna, how was your week?
Hi, all good.
Fantastic. So last week we put out a pretty interesting episode on livelihoods for Bharat. We imagined what work opportunities and employment would be like going forward, and much has changed, you know, in terms of gig economy, the new platforms that have come up and so on, and of course remote work and everything. Ramesh Kailasam, you know, speaks very eloquently on policy and especially at the overlap of tech and new innovation and stuff, and he spoke really well. And also we had Mr. Munish Chawla, who's the CEO of Jeevitam, which is an organization that does you know, employment and stuff, right? So yeah, both of them spoke really, really well. It was a deep dive into various aspects on how livelihoods will be for us. Definitely check it out in case you haven't listened to it already. This week, we're going to discuss a bunch of things. The new armed forces recruitment policy, the continuing controversy over BJP spokesperson Nupur Sharma's statements, the upcoming presidential elections, former Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf's illness and hospitalization, and much more. Let's start things off with the armed forces recruitment policy. The government has announced the creation of a new armed forces recruitment policy. This drive, known as Tour of Duty, aims to induct soldiers for short service in armed forces. This comes after a two-year hiring freeze in the Indian Army due to COVID restrictions. The Tour of Duty model envisages recruitment of personnel below officer or PBOR rank in the Army, Air Force and Navy for 4 years, including 6 months of training. Those recruited under this model will be released from service after 5 years. These recruits are likely to be given a severance package of around 10, although they will not receive pension. Nirav, we just spoke about employment and livelihoods and stuff. Army is perhaps the largest employer in India. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so I think, basically what happens is in the army, there are like two tracks. One is like the ones who join as like a soldier at the age of 17, right? After like your 12th standard. And a lot of them retire after 20 years of service, right? So you retire at 37 and then you get a big pension. You get a pension for all your life, right? And after the one rank, one pension policy, the pension bill of the army is quite high, right? So what this is aiming for is trying to get like more people in the short service commission for 4 years, and they get a one-time severance package of rupees 10 lakhs. And also this ensures that the average age of the soldiers is lower, right? Because you want, for combat troops, you want, say, younger soldiers. Some of them will be absorbed and then they will work for another 15 years, right? And after that, they'll be eligible for a pension. So I think army's classic, in like corporate parlance, it has an up and out policy, up or out policy, that either you go get promoted up or you go out, there's early retirement. And this ensures that this is what the needs are probably, and they've thought it through. And given the training that a lot of young people will receive in the army for 4 years, might leave them in good stead for like a career in the private sector in other services, right? So I think, it is a sensible policy, obviously well thought through. It's also keeping in line with like what a lot of the world does as well. And finally, the government is realizing one thing, that the main function of, say, the army or the railways or all the state-run departments, your army's main role, or the defense force, so army, navy and air force, is for protection of the country, right? And what is the best way of doing it? It is no longer a welfare organization which is providing some good jobs with a good salary and good nice benefits. So people have confused these two parts of the government, right? So I think army is focusing in on what's right for the armed forces, and not keeping it as just a, what I would call, a job guarantee scheme, like an like a welfare scheme. So I think it's a sensible thing. The pension bills are very high. So, and this ensures that the army is young and combat ready. So I don't think anything wrong in this. This is like a very good development.
Though I think you know, like there will be resistance from sections of, either the retired army establishment trying to, you know, make this entire new recruitment policy sound as if like it's a serious disruption which will undermine the operational effectiveness of the military, because their claim and contention is that for good soldiering you need this long training periods, while I think under the new scheme I think the training is 6 months and then they get commissioned, and at the end of 4 years I think only the plan is obviously to rehire or engage only 25% of those people who are hired. I think the aim is to probably look at hiring 60 to 70,000 hires through this program. So I think like some criticism has been around how, what will those 75% who don't get redeployed, like of course Nirav spoke about the optimistic scenario where their employability goes up and like ex-servicemen can always join private sector and all, but some of the, just for the sake of completeness, the argument is that they will then join private mercenary force and then they get trained from the army and then they are available being recruited for all kinds of courses and all that stuff, which I think is a very a criticism for the sake of criticism. And largely agree with Nirav that, at some point of time, this cost rationalization and making military more effective. And even I think this also kind of will achieve the aim of a more broad-based hiring, right, for the armed forces. And and I think like some people are also speaking about like the Russian forces during the Ukrainian invasion, right? Like lot of Russian army is like on hire kind of army. It's not like a permanent military workforce, actually. A lot of them have been mobilized for the purposes of the war. And there have been some, some observers who are saying that, because it's not a permanent military, it's kind of suffered setbacks during the operations and all that, actually. So, it's very important that this kind of temporary hiring is not done. But I think the cost is definitely something that we need to look at, right? Like, I think maybe the defense budget around 6.5 to 7 lakh crores, out of which I think almost 20 to 25% gets consumed on paying pensions, actually, and more so after the implementation of one rank, one pension, which itself was a demand that was spearheaded by the military officers themselves. So, the army has got little left after funding such a huge pension and benefit program for, capital, equipment purchase and state-of-the-art military equipment purchase and all that. So I think some point of time, this cost issue and, rationalization needs to be addressed, and good that government has kind of, it's biting the bullet, so as to speak. And, let's see how this progresses. It was supposed to be officially announced last week. I think I've not come across whether the Union Cabinet has officially approved it. I think like the way in which the build-up to this is happening, it almost looks like the announcement will be imminent. So maybe some part of it, we could keep it after the official, blueprint of how this entire new recruitment policy is rolled out after the Union Cabinet approval.
Yeah, and the recruitment numbers have been dipping, right? I think in 2018, 2019 also, I think it was,
I think there was a
less than the previous year.
Yeah, I think the recruitments were happening in a very tepid manner. Last 2 years, I think generally because of the COVID and pandemic related restrictions, it almost would have come to a grinding halt, because the applicants have to travel around to different locations and all that. There are so many restrictions on mobility and all. And, a lot of army recruitments are from certain geographic regions where, where you have to give them adequate time to travel and all that stuff, actually. So, but you're right that I think it's been generally you know, on a decline. Yeah.
No, I think for sure, I think we have to get a little flexible in terms of the recruitment. I think, you know, there is the short service commission. I think there's the territorial army and all of this. I think all of these definitely need a revamp of some sorts. Right. And it can be better positioned, I feel, to attract different strata of society. Right. I mean, yeah, for sure. And especially considering that, you know, it's a more of an integrated kind of warfare right now. So I think they should probably look at hiring tech folks also, right? Like we are looking at lateral in bureaucracy, why not lateral in army as well, right?
Correct.
So, yeah. All right. Some countries have condemned the remarks of BJP spokesperson Nupur Sharma. There have been continuing protests as well. Ms. Nupur Sharma, along with Naveen Kumar Jindal, made some controversial comments on a talk show on the Prophet. Muslim nations all over the world, such as Indonesia, Saudi, UAE and Afghanistan, condemned these remarks, leading to Ms. Sharma being suspended and Mr. Jindal being expelled. Protests erupted across India and two young protesters were killed on Friday as police tried to manage an unruly crowd in Jharkhand. Prasanna, I mean, this controversy, I thought, I mean, it'll die down in a week, but then somehow, I mean, it's been kept alive, right? What do you make of this?
I think very well orchestrated, deep coordinated kind of a protest. I think, like, also to some extent, you know, these protesters have been emboldened by what they see as government's meek submission. Though honestly speaking, if you really analyze it rationally, right, like once it kind of became a diplomatic role, like no country can say that. See, like if it is like a say a non-affiliated individual, like say what happened in France or some other country, or like say a free speech activist or some kind of even a social activist would have stated it. And I mean, I'm sure the government could have stood up at least saying that, you know, like this is a par for the course in the democratic discourse of the country and we can't act. But sadly, you know, I mean, I did see the video clip, right? Like it was almost like an anguished emotional waterboarding in response to the provocation during the debate, right? Like I think ultimately the context gets and the nuance kind of gets lost, right? I think, and I mean, in a very anguished way, she kind of, the BJP spokesperson, she kind of said, but you know, obviously the standards of civility and respect that or the public conduct expected of a representative of a political party is like much, much higher standards. You will be surely higher standards, but people do utter things in the heat of the moment, right? Like, and it's quite terrifying that like we have these millions of fanatics and the secular ecosystem being for the blood of a lady. Let's say like she's apologized, party has taken action. So, I mean, I really don't know like what else is the end game here. You know, I think the government and BJP also did a honorable thing of the damage control to whatever extent possible. But even to the extent that, you know, a lot of the party's own supporters are very furious for almost, you know, literally, you know, both Nupur and Jindal being, you know, no support for them and all the action. I think it incurred the wrath of the BJP support base. But honestly, I think like once it became a diplomatic role, honestly, I think the party and of course the diplomatic corps, they face the heat, right, from these Islamic nations. So pretty much very difficult. See, I think like the way that I have seen all these Middle East nations respond is that, you know, I think like they're generally not bothered about, say, the conditions of the Muslims in any country, right? Like otherwise they would have, I mean, like, say, what happens in Xinjiang or China is something that should have really got their attention, right? But you seldom see them smoking. But I think, like, somewhere, any remarks on Muhammad, who they kind of consider as their last prophet, I think is, like, always invokes this level of anger. So, you know, I really don't know what is going to be the end game. I think, like, surely the protesters have been emboldened, and, you know, and without realizing that, you know, blasphemy is not something. I mean, India is not an Islamic nation for sure, right? Like, we're kind of pushing for this blasphemy equivalent laws. And what is terribly disappointing is that, you know, this is also going to lead to counter polarization and reaction from the Hindu side, that they also need blasphemy laws, which is not how the Hindu religion has organized itself or evolved, right? Like there is space for, you know, the religion itself is so, it's not an organized religion in that sense, right? But this kind of competitive religiosity, which is basically triggered by the Islamic, the way that they have responded, I think is quite disappointing for the democratic society. And I really don't agree with a lot of criticism that this BJP supporters and base are hurling at the government, actually, because I can't think of any government in the world. I think, like, they just talk about France and other places and all. I don't think so, like, any official, official representative of a political, ruling political party saying this and then government standing by it is, I think, like, it's asking too much, right, actually, especially in today's interconnected global world. So I think they did the right thing. Hope Nupur gets adequate security, because we've seen what happened. Like, I mean, even in Scandinavian countries, right, like, all these artists who have kind of, you know, more, I mean, I don't think so, they even did it out of any animosity or something like that, but just as a in solidarity of free speech and right to dissent, they've kind of done iconoclastic things to the Islamic religious symbols. But even I think they have not been safe from the mobs, right? I think eventually either they have been attacked physically, or they live under Salman lives under the British military security for years now, right? Actually, so I really hope that we also know what happened to Kamlesh Tiwari. So it's quite tragic that just a anguish remark, you know, and people are being for the blood. Nothing much to add here.
Yeah. No, it's extremely scary. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Charlie Hebdo times, right? I mean, what happened? Pretty unfortunate. At times like this, I feel like social order is so delicate, right? I mean, it's just in a nation as big as ours, as complex as ours.
I think somehow, you know, maybe what I say is a little controversial, but here is a young lady, living lady, who's independent, educated and all. Okay, you deem that she's made a mistake, she's apologized, institutions have acted against her, you know, like, you still want to kind of, you know, do whatever, claiming that your religious book dictates and go after her. I mean, a religious figure or your prophet who lived 1,600 years back, you know, you kind of privilege that over a person who's living as a citizen among you right now. Actually, I find it personally very difficult to reconcile. I think, you know, like, leave alone any religious, blasphemy laws and all that, you know, like, fundamental decency and dignity. I mean, you respect a life now, right? Rather than getting outraged over some imagined insult over a prophet who lived 1,400 years back. So that's my sense, but I don't know. People don't, I mean, I think, like, people have their own way of looking at things, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, let's hope saner minds prevail. Moving on. The chief economic advisor, Mr. V. Anantanageshwaran, has made a statement that India could be a $20 trillion economy by 2040. The structural reforms of this government, such as the goods and services tax, GST, and the insolvency and bankruptcy code, will manifest their advantages and potential in the coming decade, the CEA said. Mr. Nageshwaran also stated that India is better positioned than many other countries in facing the current challenges. He stated that India is forecasted by the IMF to cross $5 trillion by 26-27. He added that if the GDP of the country doubles every 7 years, we will be $20 trillion by 2040 with a per capita income close to $15,000. Wow. Nirav, I mean, this is being made at a time when, you know, probably Moody's revised their forecast and IMF also has come up with some kind of a dull forecast as such, right, on India. Yeah, what do you think?
No, so I think, see, this is quite sensible. See, one is people overestimate progress. Sometimes we get too bulled up or, you know, too downbeat on the immediate things. We are in the long run, right? So what is correctly said is if you just see what we need is 10% nominal growth, say in US dollar equivalent, right? So that is our real growth plus inflation and minus any FX depreciation. So 1.1 raised to 7 is 2. So if you grow 10% over 7 years, you're compounded, you double every 10 years, every 7 years. And so we are like in 2022, so 18 years down the line, I think that is very much reachable. We will have ups and downs. We will have very periods of very strong growth, some periods of weak growth. So good thing is you see now that the GST has been implemented, you can see what sectors are doing how well, at least in the formal part of the economy, based on tax collections. There's a lot of better data because if an organization is paying so and so much GST, it's become more difficult to hide any sort of personal income taxes. So I think this is one part which is good. The second part, what you mentioned on the bankruptcy code, is also a good thing because it allows firms to die and resources, let it be people, let it be capital, etc. It's better that certain firms die. Those resources are better utilized by newer firms which come up rather than living on with zombie firms. People say that we've let, Indian government has let a lot of PSUs, or say good example is Air India. With the amount of capital which was thrown in, with the amount of people that they had, a lot of them are good people, but they were underutilized. We got a very suboptimal outcome, right? Now that it has been privatized, hopefully it turns around and Tata does a good job, or say other companies die out. Those resources can be better utilized, and this is a better efficiency or better productivity in an economy. Definitely it is there. I think Fitch got us out from our negative watch to stable. So our credit rating is stable. They had put out a negative watch during COVID. That time there was a lot of panic. Then after that, there has been a lot of euphoria. So 2020 was a year of panic. 2021, globally stock markets is a year of euphoria. 2022, again, we are looking at falling equity valuations, or startups are seeing falling valuations. So yes, you will see these ups and downs coming, but the long-term trend remains, and I totally agree with it. So I think, there isn't room for complacency. I think what happens is each time when a good times last for a short while, governments start becoming profligate and handing out either subsidies or more welfare schemes which they cannot afford when times go bad. Companies do that as well. People at a personal level also do that as well, right? So yes, there can be missteps. What we need is continuous incremental innovation, incremental improvement and efficiency. And that should be great. I think you saw last decade where China did phenomenally well. They added to the global workforce about 100 to 200 million people. So 20 crore more people who came into the workforce. Now about 100 million or so, 10 crore people are going to leave the workforce, right, in China because of aging. And the world is also rejigging the supply chains. So there is a great opportunity for India. I think India is a younger country and we're trying to get into things. We've done very well in services. If we can get agriculture and the manufacturing to pick up as well, definitely all these things, maybe it can surprise on the upside as well. But fingers crossed. But we can't be complacent. As in, we can't just say, yes, this is going to happen, so that this is conditional on we continuing to be productive and innovative and along the way. We'll face a lot of stumbling blocks, but deal with them as they come.
Yeah, I think the key operating phrase in Mr. Anant Nageswaran's statement is structural reforms, right? I mean, and these, irrespective of what the macro conditions are, will definitely have payoffs, I feel. You know, he mentioned GST, IBC, and so on. But I would even add stuff like, you know, account aggregators framework, ONDC, and all of those things that are going to come up, right? Whether it is, you know, digitization or, you know, credit access and so on. Now, these are fundamental, very, very fundamental reforms that are happening, which will, you know, which will have massive payoffs, I think. Yeah. Moving on. The Election Commission has announced that the presidential elections will be held on July 18th. The counting of votes, if required, would be held on 21st. This news comes ahead of the end of President Ramnath Kovind's term on July 24th. One of the names emerging as a favorite is Kerala Governor Dr. Arif Mohammad Khan. He joined the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2004 and was appointed as the Governor of Kerala in 2019. The 16th presidential election would be the first one to be held since the state of Jammu and Kashmir was bifurcated into two union territories. Prasanna, who do you think are the favorites? Of course, I mean, we're talking about Dr. Arif Mohammad as one of them. Any others that come to mind?
Not very sure. I think like first we might have to, one option would be to probably another term for the current incumbent president, Ramnath Kovind itself. I think that's something that is not even being discussed, which is also a possibility, though I think like, ever since President K.R. Narayan, I think like almost all the presidents have served only one term, I think. So I think like, so if go by the recent convention, maybe we get a new person as the president. Obviously, NDA doesn't have the kind of numbers that it had in the previous presidential election. I think like, maybe it has, I think it'll, on its own strength, it kind of falls marginally short of majority, but I think it might require like such level of opposition unity to even challenge. So I think it's almost, we could take for granted that it would be a BJP NDA presidential choice, and more importantly, you have two non-aligned parties with substantial electoral base for this presidential election, BJD of Odisha and YSR Congress, which is also not really identified itself with it, the opposition. So, you know, like, I think it should be a easy ride for NDA. In terms of the presidential candidates, I don't know. I think it will boil down to what is the political messaging that BJP and Prime Minister Modi would decide to project, you know, like Arif Mohammad Khan, of course, he's a formidable scholar, and you know, he's taken on the fundamentalist bigoted elements of his own community during very critical moments in India's independent history, but I think like politically, you know, there is also this loyalty factor which plays a very important role, like in all choices. He's kind of been a party hopper in the sense that after Congress, I think Janata Dal, BJP, BSP, I don't know whether he ever joined SP. So, you know, that might be a one aspect which could be weighed in. And also the calculation, right? The real politic calculation, like even if BJP wants to genuinely, look at this as an outreach to the Muslim community, especially in the light of the events that have happened in the last 2 weeks, whether there will be any reciprocation, actually, you know, like, see, ultimately, a lot of choices are determined by very tough and, I would call like very clinical political calculations, right, actually. So, like, I mean, on the other hand, you know, you've seen like BJP actually this game of giving representation to very marginal sections within the Hindu society, which were never represented in the political power structure, right? Like, even if you look at the Rajya Sabha nominations across the states, right? So, I mean, I was quite surprised that, like, we always discuss about Muslim non-representation in, at least in the BJP side of politics, but, like, seldom discussed fact is that lot of other parties, right? Like, either you have caste-based parties or you have Congress. They've never really given adequate representation to a lot of substantial communities within the Hindu society itself, which could be nationally 3%, 5%, 7% and all, right? And that never comes into the public discourse or discussion, actually. So, you know, like, it could be, like, probably from one of those marginal groups which never have had political representation. That could be a second option, actually. So I don't think so. Arif Muhammad Khan is like a foregone conclusion or something like that, right? Actually, so maybe, like, between the president and vice president, maybe they might still go for a candidate from the minority community, say for the vice president, because I think, like, their BJP's own Muslim representation in the parliament, right, is now zero, because I think two Muslim members' term is coming to an end, actually. So maybe whether that will again be irk the minority community, because you virtually have not given them any political representation, though, you know, all election studies show that, like, BJP draws like 1-2% support from the Muslim community, which, I mean, so it cuts both ways, actually. So I don't know whether, unless they are very conscious and they want to kind of outreach and create a bridge, whether they will kind of elevate a minority candidate. But my bet will be on, say, giving representation, which is, I think, what BJP's model has been for the last 8 years, to sections of the society within the Hindu community which have not had representation. That will be my bet, but you never know what's the thinking, actually.
Right. What do you make of President Kovind's tenure?
I think very dignified and very low profile, and, you know, like, that's, see, actually, the president is meant to play that kind of a ceremonial role when there is a duly elected majority government, right? I think, like, only when there is a fractured mandate, or where there is a lot of political confusion, right? That's where he has to step in and do that. I think he's kind of acquitted himself very, very well, and very low profile, but I think, like, he's made his mark, and important that non-confrontational relationship is also very important, actually, right? Like, especially when you have a government with such thumping majority, which has been elected with the huge popular support, I think makes no sense to go on a collision course. Even otherwise, he's been a stickler for constitutional norms, right? And I don't think so there is any instance where, even, for instance, Abdul Kalam, who was like a terrific exemplary president who kind of, you know, fired the imagination of the nation, maybe you can say his Bihar, signing the dismissal of the Bihar government was probably a kind of a controversial decision. But in Govind's case, even can't think of anything remotely controversial that he's done, actually. So I think it was a good tenure, you know.
All right. In some geopolitical news, US and China defense ministers clashed over Taiwan in Singapore. Top defense officials of China and the US sparred over Taiwan at their first face-to-face meeting on Friday. China threatened to quote, crush any independence plot, with the US urging them to not carry out destabilizing actions on the island. They were meeting against the backdrop of rising tension between the two largest economies over a range of issues, including Taiwan, territorial disputes in the South China Sea, human rights issues in Xinjiang and Tibet, as well as the erosion of rights in Hong Kong. Nirav, I mean, it just continues to escalate, right? I mean, at this point of time, some kind of it just seems an eventuality that something will happen in Taiwan. What do you think?
Okay, so one thing, like, This meeting is part of the Shangri-La dialogue, which happens regularly in Singapore, where all the defense ministers of the major nations come in, right? So that is like thing number one. The thing is, what has happened is you had the US defense secretary, Lloyd Austin. He's kind of called out China for doing some aggressive, like flying planes over the Taiwan Strait, like crossing over the border. There's been some kind of like, not exactly clash, but there were some Australian planes which were doing some recon exercises, and Chinese fighter jets kind of pushed them back. So there's been a little bit of that. Obviously, China, as they famously say, right, that it has, I think, borders with some 16 countries and disputes with 18. Like in the South China Sea, they have some issues, etc. So now, Taiwan is right now very important because kind of people are drawing parallels of Russia, Ukraine with like, say, China and Taiwan, right? And the official policy, most countries, including India, we have like a one China policy, right? Where we recognize that the government of China is ruling over China. The government in Taiwan is actually people, when the Communist Party took power in 1949, the KMT leaders, they escaped away to Taiwan and they set up a new government there. And in reality, like the Taiwanese government considers themselves, they call themselves Republic of China, and China is People's Republic of China. And Taiwan also has like that way considers all of China as its part of its territory, right? So, and what US has, they call it the policy of strategic ambiguity, right? Where they say kind of like, yes, we recognize one China policy, but this Taiwan is kind of like a quasi-independent nation, etc. Now, what has happened is Biden has come out and said, away from this policy of strategic ambiguity, that if US invades China, if China invades Taiwan, US will protect it, which is not like an official policy. And that was a blooper that was retracted later on. So this has been raised, and the Chinese defense minister Wei Fenghe has said that it is like Taiwan is part of China, and any sort of policy to try and like remove it will be met with confrontation, right? And both sides are calling each other for aggression and bullying. So that's what the backdrop is. Taiwan is very, very critical to the world because of TSMC. Which is the world's leading manufacturer of very high-end chips. So high-end semiconductors, I think the very high-end, whatever is they call them, 7 nanometer and lower. You guys had a very nice episode on semiconductors, but I think TSMC controls like 90% of the production of that, right? So Taiwan is very, very critical. It is right at the doorstep of China. Taiwan has US military bases. US also against China, they've got a policy of what they call it as the island chain, like right from Japan, island of Jeju Island of South Korea, so Okinawa of Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, etc. They have like a lot of military bases all across, like on the borders of China. So I think, yes, there is some clash. We don't know whether this Russia and Ukraine conflict, where there's been a lot of sanctions on Russia, maybe does it make China bolder, saying that the sanctions didn't have any impact, or actually more wary? We don't know. I think all of the Chinese government is going for the next term. They have the National Party Congress in October. So from November onwards, a new leadership comes in. Xi Jinping is looking. So while they don't have like popular elections with the people, but they have to win the inner party approval of the Chinese Communist Party, the working committee. And he's changed the law, which limited him to 2 terms. So anyone can, now there are no term limits. So, but he does need to get renominated by the party. So I don't think any such things will happen. Both sides are kind of raising the verbal tension, if so as to say, right, in the Taiwan Strait. And that is what it is. I think both sides, sometimes when you have economic pressures, right, everybody needs a villain. And maybe both sides are portraying as the other as a villain to blame for the economic troubles at home. I think China has a bit more economic trouble right now than the US, but US has problem of inflation. China has problem of like too strict a zero COVID policy and like lower growth. And I think this is, in my opinion, I don't see, maybe it's an eventuality over like a medium term, but I don't see any immediate military confrontation. There's going to be some sort of like people stepping into the other's territory, you know, like just crossing the strait like a little bit here and there. But there's not going to be any actual aggression.
All right. According to sources, former Pakistan military ruler Parvez Musharraf is gravely ill. Mr. Musharraf has been hospitalized for 3 weeks and the family has asked for prayers for his health. He's unlikely to recover. His family had tweeted that he was going through a difficult stage where recovery is not possible and organs are malfunctioning. Mr. Musharraf has been living in the United Arab Emirates since 2016, when a travel ban was lifted and he was allowed to travel to Dubai to seek medical treatment. Well, Prasanna, I mean, he is perhaps the top five Pakistanis that anyone will think of, right? I mean, at least, you know, those of our generation, I think. Yeah, extremely controversial figure. What do you think his legacy is?
I don't know. He doesn't seem to be fondly remembered now, right? Actually, I think like when he was in ruling, right? I think he had some popularity, certainly. But I don't really see Pakistan citizens or anybody fondly recalling his rule, though I think he provided a modicum of stability. And in fact, I think a lot of technocrats were inducted into the government decision-making process during his time and all that. So, I mean, I'm not sure it's any worse than what unfolded after that, right, in Pakistan. So, I mean, from India's perspective, of course, you know, like any military general tried to use terror as a state instrument to create chaos, actually. So I think I don't really have any insights about how his legacy is viewed domestically within Pakistan, though. Actually, maybe Nirav can chip in.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, like having interacted with Pakistan, having lived in Dubai and like in Singapore, and having interacted with Pakistanis, right? I think what happened is like Musharraf quickly became persona non grata, as like Prasanna mentioned, right? Like at that time, at one time, he was extremely popular, but after the Nawaz Sharif government took over, etc., that kind of got sidelined. And now what has happened is like Pakistan politics is in a bit of a chaos as well. After Imran Khan was deposed and like you have Shahbaz Sharif as the PM, but the real power, as everyone knows, lies with the military, right? So that is what it is. I think Musharraf, being an articulate general, was always quoted by like the Western media, etc., talking about like Pakistan. And he was, I would say, like more popular amongst TV studios rather than popular within Pakistan itself. So, see, that is whatever it is. See, I think all other differences aside, he did rise to the like lead the Pakistani army, right? So definitely he's a capable person. Like a lot of rulers, Pakistan is not a great place for retirement for deposed rulers, right? All of them, once they lose election, they either live in London or Dubai. And that is what it is, which says something about like the state of civil society as well. So that's a sad thing. And maybe see, he's getting on with age. I have like no idea whether he recovers or not, but yeah, wish him quick recovery if at all. And we'll see. I think today him passing away does not have any implication either to Pakistan politics or to India or Indo-Pak relations, if I would put it that way. Like, he's an ex-leader, and who's an ex-leader in exile, and doesn't really have any power as such.
Yeah, no, he was quoted fairly well by, you know, the Western think tanks, policy organizations, media, and everything, right? I mean, if you just go down the rabbit hole in on YouTube, you will find plenty of his talks, right? And very warmly received by them also, and pretty interesting talks also. I mean, if you can at the filter of, you know,
where so he's a very articulate. So he's a very articulate person.
Yeah.
So I think definitely that is why he's very popular with the Western media houses and think tanks, right? So absolutely. But in terms of like popular support on the ground, he didn't have much, or in reality, he didn't have much influence over policy either ways, either on the army or on the civilian government.
Correct.
Yeah. All right, we come to the end of the weekly. We have a couple of very interesting episodes lined up for this week. We're talking about delivering social welfare with Aniket Dogar, who is the co-founder of Haq Darshak. Very interesting organization that has this assisted tech platform where they help, you know, about 800 million or so of the people who are eligible for these schemes and so on, really get the benefit from these schemes, right? And also we have Mr. Graham Connolly, who is a noted political commentator, talking about Australia's elections, the AUKUS, South China Sea developments, and a bunch of geopolitical stuff. A couple of very, very good episodes lined up for this week and later in this month as well. So from Prasanna, Nirav, and myself, thank you so much for joining us this week. Stay safe, take care, and have a great week ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.